Konstanz. She's waiting. She's waiting for her man.
Hi, I'm Martin, and this is Kaput Radio. Folks, it's burning all over the continent here of Australia, and people are tense and not so inclined towards satire presently. Therefore, I chose for you some material today from German history, and it's his and not her story. Although it's not all dry and serious. Many people remember the term German economic Wunderkind or Wonderchild, relating to the post-World War II period with the infusion of the Marshall Plan, a post-Nazi German rebuilding program introducing Hollywood, Elvis Presley and US capital into West Germany, as it was called then. But little is known about another German economic miracle taking place during the early 1930s. Why is that of interest, you may ask? Well, folks, it has a lot to do with understanding the global monetary system and a certain numerical unlikeliness to produce economically what Germany has rebuilt during the years of 1930 until 1938, if we have to believe official his story. But let's start at the beginning of the post-29 world crash. After the crash, a recession takes place, and the rescue remedy is always borrowing lots of money to grow the economy again, in order to pull people out of unemployment and poverty, they say. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Money is scarce.
Piles of crisp cash counted into fat little hundreds, pert pieces of copper coinage thrust deep into trouser pockets, romantic foreign money rolling against the thigh with rough familiarity, beautiful wayward curlicued banknotes, filigree copper plating cheek by jowl with tumbling hexagonal milled edges, rubbing gently against the terse leather of beautifully balanced bank books.
The Mark Weber Report.
The most devastating economic downturn of the 20th century, by far, was the world economic crisis of the 1930s, the Great Depression. The great overwhelming challenge was the crisis that had brought mass unemployment and global economic paralysis. In early 1933, industrial production in the U.S., as well as in Germany, was scarcely more than half of what it had been in 1929. And although there are some striking parallels between the policies and projects of the Roosevelt government in the U.S. and the Hitler government in Germany, the results were very different. Perhaps the most influential American economist of the 20th century was John Kenneth Galbraith. He was an advisor to several presidents and for a time served as U.S. ambassador to India. He was the author of several dozen books, and for years he taught economics at Harvard University. On this subject, Galbraith wrote, "The elimination of unemployment in Germany during the Great Depression without inflation and with initial reliance on essential civilian activities was a signal accomplishment. It has rarely been praised and not much remarked. The German regime's economic policy," Galbraith goes on, "involved large-scale borrowing for public expenditures and, at first, this was principally for civilian work, railroads, canals, and the Autobahnen superhighways. The result was a far more effective attack on unemployment than in any other industrial country." By late 1935, Galbraith goes on, "unemployment was at an end in Germany. By 1936, high income was pulling up prices or making it possible to raise them. Germany, by the late 30s, had full employment at stable prices. It was, in the industrial world, an absolutely unique achievement. Other countries, Galbraith goes on, failed to understand or to learn from the German experience. He writes, "The German example was instructive but not persuasive. British and American conservatives looked at the Nazi financial heresies, the borrowing and spending, and uniformly predicted a breakdown. And American liberals and British socialists looked at the repression, the destruction of the unions, the brown shirts, the black shirts, the concentration camps, and screaming oratory, and ignored the economics. Nothing good, they believed, not even full employment, could come from Hitler." Historian John Lukacs, an ardent critic of Hitler and his regime, but also a perceptive writer, has summed up the record in these words. "Hitler's achievements, domestic rather than foreign, during the six peacetime years of his leadership of Germany were extraordinary. He brought prosperity and confidence to the Germans, the kind of prosperity that is the result of confidence. The 30s, after 1933, were sunny years for most Germans, something that remained in the memories of an entire generation among them. Rejecting the sometimes cloudy and impractical economic views of more radical activists in his party, Hitler turned to men of proven ability and competence. He enlisted the help of Hjalmar Schacht, a prominent banker and financier with a brilliant record in both private business and public service. Even though Schacht was certainly no National Socialist, Hitler appointed him as president of the Reichsbank, Germany's central bank, a position somewhat comparable in the U.S. to chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And then he was appointed as Minister of Economics, a post similar in the U.S. to Secretary of the Treasury. After taking power, writes Professor John Garrity, a prominent American historian, Hitler and his new government immediately launched an all-out assault on unemployment. They stimulated private industry through subsidies and tax rebates, encouraged consumer spending by such means as marriage loans, and plunged into the massive public works program that produced the Autobahn highway system and housing, railroad, and navigation projects. As he had promised in his first radio address to the nation, Hitler and his National Socialist government banished unemployment within 4 years. The number of jobless was cut from more than 6 million at the beginning of 1933, when he took power, to 1 million by 1936. The jobless rate was reduced so rapidly that by 1938, there was a national labor shortage. For the great mass of ordinary Germans, wages and working conditions improved steadily. Real weekly earnings increased from 1932 to 1938 by 21%, and by 1943, average hourly earnings of German workers had risen by 25%. And this with fixed rents and a relative decline in the costs of heating and light. The normal workday for Germans was limited by law to 8 hours, and was generally between 7 and 8 hours, with generous overtime pay. The already extensive network of social welfare programs, including old age insurance and a national health care program, was expanded. In addition to higher wages, benefits included markedly improved working conditions, such as better health and safety conditions, canteens with subsidized hot meals, athletic fields, parks, subsidized theater performances and concerts, exhibitions, sport and hiking groups, dances, adult education courses, and subsidized tourism.
Money! Money!
Money, 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 money.
smell of the rain-washed florin, the lure of the lira, the glitter and glory of the guinea, the romance of the ruble, the feel of the franc, the stiff heel of the Deutschmark, and the bisexual euro, appealing desperately to everybody. I've got £90,000 in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots and lots of lira. Now the Deutschmark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing like a newly minted pound. Everyone must think of all the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that makes the world go round. You can keep your Marxist ways, it's only just a phase. Or it's money, money, money makes the world go round. Words still as true today as when they were first written over 15 minutes ago.
A few representative figures give an idea of how the quality of life improved for Germans during the Hitler era, certainly at least in the period of peace. Between 1932, the last year of the pre-Hitler era, and 1938, the last full year of peace before the outbreak of war, food consumption increased by one-sixth, while clothing and textile turnover increased by more than a quarter, and of furniture and household goods by 50%. During the Third Reich's peacetime years, wine consumption rose by 50%, and champagne consumption increased fivefold. Between 1932 and 1938, the volume of tourism more than doubled, while automobile ownership in Germany tripled during the 1930s. German business revived and prospered. During the first 4 years of the National Socialist era, net profits of large corporations quadrupled, and managerial and entrepreneurial income rose by nearly 50%. Jewish historian Richard Grunberger, in his detailed study, The 12-Year Reich, writes, things were to get even better. In the 3 years between 1939 and 1942, German industry expanded as much as it had during the preceding 50 years. German foreign trade, both import and export, increased sharply during the Hitler era, not only with other European countries, but also in other regions, notably with South America and East Asia. German motor vehicle production, which included cars made by the U.S.-owned Ford and General Motors Works, doubled in the 5 years of 1932 to 1937, while Germany's motor vehicle exports increased eightfold. Air passenger traffic in Germany from 1933 to 1937 more than tripled. Taxation in National Socialist Germany was progressive or graduated. That is, those of higher income paid proportionately more in taxes than those in the lower income brackets. In the world of finance, no restrictions were placed upon the activities of Jewish firms in the Berlin stock market, and until 1937, the banking houses of Mendelssohn, Bleichröder, Arnhold, Dreyfus, Strauss, Warburg, Aufhäuser, and Barron's were still active. An interesting analysis comparing the American and German approaches to the Great Depression appeared in a May 1940 issue of the Berlin weekly paper Das Reich, one of wartime Germany's most literate and thoughtful periodicals. The article stated, quote, "We Germans began with an idea and carried out the practical measures without regard for consequences. America began with many practical measures that, without inner coherence, covered over each wound with a special bandage."
have that kind of knack, and it may not be coincidental that he was black. He was sitting in his car, they say he might have had a gun. What we know for sure is he had 5 kids, daughters and sons. Now he can't have a family, he'll never see his friends. His neighbors understand what kind of message this sends. Some life is worth less, some life is worth more. You don't have to be a mathematician to know the score. Some people get shot just for being who they are. Some people play with iPads, take vacations, drive in fancy cars. Some people go to universities, some people do not. It depends on where you were born and how much money you got. The government cuts their spending, widening the divide, then reacts with disbelief when they face the rising tide of anger at the cuts, at the futures that they rob. With each day so many have to live without a job. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. Cameron went on TV in his suit and tie. If the riots asked the question, then this was his reply. We'll arrest these hooligans, these people without shame. They are only criminals, and it's only criminals to blame. Morals have decayed among the peasants' ranks, so let us lock them up while we bail out the banks. When that's the way they look at it, it's not very hard to watch things fall apart in this house of cards. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. These kids have too much freedom, and all this is just a sign that we need more policemen to teach them some respect. Well, if that's your line, then I know just what you can expect. The class will be repeated until the lesson has been learned. All you need is some injustice to make your cities burn. All you need is the perception, whether or not it's true, that most of us will never live the way you do. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down.
A person who has written a detailed analysis of this is the American historian John Garrity. He wrote a much discussed article published in the American Historical Review titled The New Deal, National Socialism, and the Great Depression that generated quite a lot of discussion and is well worth reading today. In this article, John Garrity wrote, quote, "The two movements, that is, in the U.S. and in Germany, nevertheless reacted to the Great Depression in similar ways, distinct from those of other industrial nations. Of the two, the Nazis were the more successful in curing the economic ills of the 1930s. They reduced unemployment and stimulated industrial production faster than the Americans did, and, considering their resources, handled their monetary and trade problems more successfully, certainly more imaginatively. By 1936, the Depression was substantially over in Germany, far from finished in the United States. In fact, in the United States, as well as in much of the rest of the world, the jobless rate remained high until the stimulation of war production took hold. It was war production, not Roosevelt's New Deal programs, that finally brought full employment in the United States." I want to go back in that regard to a point made by John Kenneth Galbraith, who, as I mentioned, was probably or perhaps the most influential American historian of the 20th century. He makes the point that in the United States and Britain, by both leftists and rightists, there was ignorance and prejudice and hatred against the Third Reich that prevented not only an awareness, but much more an acknowledgement of the reality of the way in which the National Socialist government dealt with the economic crisis of the 1930s. Now, at a time, as we are living through today, when America is facing such enormous anxiety, economic problems, social disillusion, and so forth, it's all the more important to be able to understand the lessons that other countries have learned from dealing with problems similar to our own.
In The Meaning of Life, we portrayed accountants as pirates. Now, where did we get that idea? Time, I think, for an accountant sea shanty.
You're listening to
Kaput
Radio.
Completely Kaput.
Authorised by New South Wales Government, Sydney.
Time, I think, for a song. We've moved from spam to sperm. Time, I think, to offend the Chinese. Thank you, Sinophiles. This next song was strangely number one in Australia and banned in Birmingham. And I'd like to dedicate this to NATO, who are developing a new highly sophisticated bomb, which is so sophisticated it takes you to the opera before accidentally killing you. The world today is absolutely crackers, with nuclear bombs to blow us all sky high. There's fools and idiots sitting on the trigger. It's depressing and it's senseless, and that's why I like Chinese. I like Chinese. They only come up to your knees, yet they're always friendly and they're ready to please. I like Chinese. I like Chinese. There's about a billion of them in the world today. You'd better learn to like them, that's what I say. I like Chinese. And they're ready to please. I like Chinese food. The waiters never are rude. Think of the many things they've done to impress. There's Maoism, Taoism, I Ching and chess.
Like
anything to shout about. The Chinese will survive us all without any doubt. Hasn't had a lesson in his life. I like Chinese, I like Chinese. We sometimes bomb their embassies, but we don't really mean to. We thought they were trees. All together, whoa,
I jungle them.
You heard samples from a chap calling himself Mark Webber with his Mark Webber Report. For me, a little bit of Nazi defender type, it seems, but his historical quotes are quite accurate. For me, only one question wafts in and out of this statement. How did Nazi German create its money? When you look at the so-called economic miracle, the miracle must lie in the method of creating finance. Not as debt, but as a social credit, and I suspect that's what the Nazis did. But that's up for speculation, folks. Also on the show, you heard Eric Idle and David Robix. Finally, folks, I lost my email by some attack, and it wasn't me sending out spam mail under my name. Sorry if it annoyed a few people. I have a new email box, which you can find securely on the contact producer button on the program page of this and future shows here at radioforall.net. And look, folks, I have no home connection, come to this IP connection once or twice a week. I mean, it's hard to keep up with this crazy digital hijacking and up and out botting your computer, etc. You see, I don't buy or sell in this space. I'm DOOC, long ago. That means dropped out of commerce. It's just simple, not-for-profit community radio with unpaid volunteers, and I'm one of them. My only accomplishment in life has been fighting off the oxidants and toxic radicals in my body sufficiently so far. I am alive. So, I hope I didn't lose your trust with this affair and keep you interested in Kaput Radio in the future. Catch you all soon!
Almost. I would like to know what you are searching for. I too would like to know I would like to know what you are searching for. I too would like to know perhaps nonetheless this flame does not fail to glimmer. I would like to know what you are searching for. I too would like to know. I remember that the verb to find does not first of all mean to find. I remember that the verb to find does not first of all mean to find in the sense of a practical or a scientific result. To find is to turn. To take a turn about. To go around. I would like to know what you are searching for. I would like to know. I too would like to perhaps know how this flame does not fail to glimmer. How this flame turns about and go around. Nonetheless, I would like to know what you are searching for. More accurately, it turns about a verb without complement. It does not turn around something or even nothing. I would like to know how you turn towards the glimmer. And I too would like to know how the flame complements without. My flame, my glimmer, my error, my essential error, my silence is without relation to the true. And my error holds no firmness, unable to glimmer and unable to become a swamp. To error, to go outside, I confess. To not seeing your error, to not seeing your silence, a true misunderstanding. I wonder how you tolerate me. How you bear with me. How you see me. This is perhaps the easiest. Speech and error are on intimate terms. I would like to know what you're seeing. I would like to know what you're hiding from yourself. I want to see you. I want to fail to see you. I want to invite myself into your mystery. Into your pathways. I want to inspect them. I want to suspend the moments. The moments pending, shivering. The moments somehow left between the hidden and the seen. I want to insert myself in there. As a vase.